The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 32. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. He's someone that I've been following a long time. He is definitely one of my favorites in macroeconomics and finance. His name is Jeff Snyder, and he is with Alhambra Investments. Jeff, thanks for being on the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thank you, George. Pleasure to be here. You know, if you want to start with the Bank of England paper, it's not a bad place to start. I don't agree with much of the, but it does get one thing right, which I think is the key thing, is that money is created by banks. And that's really the only thing we need to start with as far as that's concerned. I get that right.
Well, I'm actually glad to hear you say that, Jeff, because I've been racking my brain over that report literally for a month. Seriously, for a month, every single weekend, probably 8 hours a weekend, trying to figure it out. And there's so many discrepancies where they contradict themselves within that report. Sometimes they say that they supply the reserves on demand. And then in other places, they say that those reserves go with the deposit. And therefore, the bank can get low on reserves, which would actually restrict the amount of lending or money creation that they can do. But it's every single page, they say something different. And I thought, am I just stupid? Am I not following this? Or is this report written wrong? So it's great to hear you say that there's some errors there.
Well, you know what it is, George? It's the fact that these are people who have been steeped in the orthodox of monetary scholarship, which is very thin to begin with. And it's been thin for decades now. And so they're coming at this from the perspective of inside the system. You know, inside the central bank. And from inside the central bank, they cannot imagine how the actual system works because they're so far down into the minutiae, they can't see the big picture. And I run across this all the time with people who work in the banking system. Right, you know, they can't really figure out what is, you know, the system doesn't seem to work the way everybody says it does. Yet, you know, I can't figure out how it actually does work.
And yeah, because all they can see is their balance sheet.
Right. And not even the balance sheet. Most people in the banking system, including the central bankers, they have a very narrow task. Like they have a very narrow mandate. Somebody working in the banking system might only have, you know, they work on a specific desk and they have a very limited visibility because they're only doing one thing. You know, they're trading interest rate swaps. They don't know what those are for or why they're doing it. They're just trying to make as much money as they can on interest rate swaps. And the same thing in a central bank capacity, too. A lot of the staff economists, first of all, they come at it from the orthodox perspective, but even those that say at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who might be into the weeds, so to speak, they're coming at it from a very narrow perspective where they can't really put all the pieces together. So I think that's symptomatic of what you see in the Bank of England report is, we know money isn't the way it's taught in the economics textbook. We don't know what it is either. We can't really come at the situation any better. Except for this one thing that we say in this report is that money is not created by central banks. It's created by the banking system. You know, Milton Friedman and others said a long time ago, money creation is done by the bookkeeper's pen. And the bookkeeper is a banker. So that's what, you know, if anybody reads the Bank of England report or any of those like it, the key takeaway from it is that money is a bank creation. It's a credit-based monetary system. And that opens up the door to all this other stuff.
And is that just in the retail side of it? So in what I would call the difference between the real economy and the financial economy, or can the Fed print money or create money and then spend it into deposits into the retail banking system by buying treasuries or assets that were actually held in the private sector?
Well, what the Fed does is it creates bank reserves, which sounds like it should be money, right? I mean, bank reserves, that historically bank reserves for money. I think, you know, George, maybe it'll help if we go through a simple example of what I'm talking about in terms of money creation in a credit-based system.
Sure.
Hey, let's pretend I'm a bank. Let's pretend you're a bank in Medellin. I'm in Florida. So we're in Florida. I actually happen to have a $5 bill, which is a Federal Reserve note. It's a physical currency. It's not actual money because we don't use money anymore. We only use currency. So this is U.S. currency. You say to me, hey, Jeff, I need that $5, right, for whatever reason. You're in Florida, I'm in Colombia, you know, all we need to do is, okay, I just gave you the $5. What happens is, I'm a bank in Florida, you're a bank outside the United States. You write down on your assets and liabilities that you got $5 from me. It's a computerized transaction. It's a ledger transaction. This $5 bill never goes anywhere. It stays with me in my pocket or my vault, so to speak. But what we've done is, you know, I've created a $5 asset, which is an interbank loan to you. I have an offsetting liability. You've created you now have a $5 liability to me that goes on your books, and an offsetting asset, which is cash and cash equivalents. So we've actually doubled the money supply from $5 to $10 through nothing more than electronic transmission. This $5 currency stays with me. It doesn't go anywhere. Now, if you were a bank, say in Chicago, and we did the same transaction, there would be a reserve requirement where I would actually, you know, if the reserve requirement was 8% like it used to be, I'd have to send you 40 cents at least. We couldn't just say that we spent $5. I'd have to send you 40 cents. And that you wouldn't be able to do the transaction until you got the 40 cents, because you'd have to have some liquid currency in reserves. So the fact that you're offshore, and this is why I talk about the offshore system so much, is there's no reserve requirement. It's a reserveless system. So the very fact that you and I say, hey, I have this $5 bill, but I on my books, I gave it to you. I lent it to you. There's no reserve requirement. You can then say, Jeff, you're a bank in the United States. You're good for the $5. I now have that $5 on my books too. Now here's the real thing. Now that the $5 is floating around on your books, you can do all sorts of things with it. You have $5 in cash and cash equivalents. Now you have an offsetting liability, which is an interbank loan to me. But as far as anybody knows, you're a bank, I'm a bank. You have that $5. So you can go to somebody else who says, you know what? I know a guy who wants to invest in a factory in Singapore. He needs dollars because the world needs dollars. The dollar is the reserve currency, and the dollars are the way these things get done. What you can say is, I've got $5. I just got $5 from this guy from this bank in Florida. We went through the interbank market, this wholesale interbank market. He has $5. Now I have $5. And guess what? I'll lend it to you. So now we all have $5.
And dollars.
$5. We all have $5. Right. And there's only the one single currency. This is the only one that's out there. But yet, because we're in this offshore space where it's a reserveless system, as long as you're willing to create a liability and an offsetting asset, and I'm willing to do the same thing, and the guy that you're doing business with that wants to go to Singapore does the same thing, we're all creating money out of thin air. It's the bookkeeper's pen.
Right. And if the bank that first had the $5 in the United States, let's say the Medellin Bank, and if there's no reserve requirements, is there anything that would limit them or prevent them from lending out more than that $5?
Theoretically, it's unlimited, right? Because, you could just lend and lend and lend. But
that's why
we live in the real world. Even if we go offshore, which is why, you know, the offshore system got so big, the regulations aren't what they are onshore. However, there are still constraints. You know, you have to think about how a bank puts together its balance sheet. I'm gonna be concerned about risk. You know, George, if I think you're a risky bank, yeah, maybe I don't want to lend to you. Or if I'm concerned about, you know, if this $5 has to go someplace else, you know, I have my own balance sheet constraints that usually they always pertain to the basics of finance, which are risk versus return. So when I lend you that $5 in the interbank market, I expect to get paid from it. You're going to send me some interest. And if that interest is good enough and the risk is low enough, then we'll create that money.
But if they miscalculated risk, like in the forms of the mortgage-backed securities before 2007, then they create all this money thinking that it's almost risk-free, when in reality, there was a tremendous amount of risk there.
Right, which they never appreciated, because up until that point, it had, you know, recency bias and confirmation bias. Nothing bad had happened, so nothing bad could ever happen. That was the thought. And oh, by the way, if we do run into trouble, you know, Ben Bernanke's there. The Federal Reserve will bail us all out, because that's what we've been taught since we were kids in school.
Right.
And that we found out that wasn't true either. And the reason why, or a key reason why the Fed doesn't matter as much as people say, is in that transaction between you and me, I create an asset. I have a $5 asset that's an interbank loan to you. But what is the liability I record? Well, you know, the Bank of England paper and traditional economics says it's a deposit. But it doesn't have to be a deposit. It could be a currency swap. It could be any form of derivative. We could be very creative in how we fund this transaction between you and me. And you could be just as creative how you fund the transaction between you and the other guy. And then he gets creative. And And so we have all of these derivatives at play that don't function the same way as a depository system would. It gets utterly complicated. It gets very, very hard to untangle, especially when we're trading liabilities back and forth. And none of these things really conform to the traditional basic ideas of what is money. It's not this. It's bank liabilities of all kinds.
And I want to make sure that everyone's following us here. When you say liabilities, that could be, or most of the time, that's considered a deposit, because the bank, the deposits are a liability for the bank. So I think as the average person listens to you, they hear liability, they think of their balance sheet, where a liability is actually like a mortgage that they have, and an asset would be the deposit. But when you're talking about it from the bank's balance sheet, from their standpoint, those deposits are liabilities. And to your point, some sort of maybe derivative or who knows what else could be on that side of the balance sheet along with those deposits.
Yeah, George, that's a good point. I'm glad you're pointing it out, because from the bank perspective, everything's reversed, right?
Right.
Because the mortgage is an asset for the bank. So any kind of loan is an asset, any kind of claim on somebody else. So what I would, you know, that $5 loan between you and me, for me, is an asset, because I've lent you $5. I have a $5 claim on you. It's an interbank loan. And I have to create an offsetting liability, which is a, you know, for a bank, it's the funding side. And traditionally, you're right. If everybody's taught the traditional money multiplier of bank fractional reserve banking, right? You take in some cash and then you multiply out into loans and then offsetting deposits. But what we're talking about is very different from that.
Right.
And so, you know, you're right to point out that for me, a liability is just the funding side. You know, what is the funding side of the asset side?
Yeah. And the main reason it's different, if I'm hearing you right, is because there's no reserve requirement. That is the key.
That's one of the keys. You know, the others, there's others, but that you know, that's how we get from the traditional notion of fractional reserve depository lending into this modern commercial banking wholesale system, which operates very differently. Very different rules, very different methods, very different conventions. And reserves, you know, it's a reserveless system, because in the truth, nobody wants the currency. Who wants to trade $5 bills back and forth? It's much easier for us to just computerize our transactions and just put numbers on a computer screen.
Yeah, just like a scoreboard at an NBA game or something.
Yeah, exactly. That's all it is. As long as your numbers on your computer match my numbers on my computer, everything is good. Yeah. When they start to not match, that's when things start to go awry. And then you start asking, in a reserveless system, where do you go? Where do you go for recourse? You're supposed to be able to go to the Fed, but if we have a currency swap arrangement, we have some derivative transaction between us, what good is QE and what the Fed can do? You know, I can't go to the discount window. So, you know, it's a very different way of doing money, and it's incredibly complex, and it spans the entire globe, because this we're really talking about with the dollar system is the world's reserve currency. And so these dollars, these fake virtual dollars, I call them euro dollars, because the term euro dollar means offshore dollars. It has nothing to do with the European currency. Right. Euro dollar means offshore dollars. And all of these offshore dollars, and there are trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions. In fact, nobody knows how many there are, because it's all between banks. And so these trillions of dollars that operate between banks offshore, everybody around the world needs them. The global economy runs on these euro dollars.
To circle back there, so everyone is following this, the reason the world needs a global currency outside of the dollar is because they need it to expand as they see fit, and they don't want to leave that up to the gold standard in the past, or now the Federal Reserve, as far as expanding and creating enough dollars that the world needs to grow or do whatever they need to do.
Exactly. You know, that's really the thing, is that, you know, we have to envision a world where we need the monetary resources to do all of the things that we all take for granted in you know, in the 21st century. And the gold standard the Bretton Woods standard in particular was highly flawed. It didn't really fit to the globalizing economy. And so there was no mechanism available that allowed for an increase in monetary resources that could fill the demand for money, these US dollars or euro dollars, that would allow the globalizing economy to spread and do all of the good things that a globalizing economy does. And so the euro dollar system evolved in the 50s and 60s as a way to circumvent the Bretton Woods era first, and then eventually just replace it.
Right. And the reason they need more currency to grow is because if they didn't, it'd be extremely deflationary. and they would have a lot of problems servicing debt and a lot of other things, correct?
Well, yeah, just think about it in terms of logistics. If we're actually, you know, have to send physical currency around the world, it's cumbersome. It's very difficult. You have to hire all sorts of people to keep track of, you know, whether it's gold coins or bars or bullions, whatever. It's a very difficult system to have to actually transfer physical money all over the place. So a ledger system, an electronic ledger system, is much more elegant and efficient. And there's obviously downsides to it too. It can get going too far and get itself into trouble, as we saw in the 2000s. But in terms of, you know, the evolution of money, the evolution of banking, it was the next logical step in the progression of our modern economic society.
Right. So that's the balancing act, I think, is how do you create a system that keeps human beings in check while at the same time allowing for optimal growth? I guess we haven't figured that out yet.
the Bretton Woods system was probably way too restrictive, whereas the euro-dollar replacement was way too flexible and compliant. You know, it went way too far in the other direction. And so, you know, it is a very difficult thing to try to figure out what is the right balance. And the problem is we don't allow for any mechanism to check, because a lot of what, you know, we're talking about these Eurodollar bank-centric liabilities and whatnot, they're all hidden. That's why I call it shadow money, too, because a lot of what goes on in the Eurodollar system never sees the light of day. And so there was no way to really decide, is this thing getting too far out of control? Or is it, how would we even know? And you can't depend upon central banks, because central banks are always focused on their own national economies and their own national systems rather than what's going on in this offshore vacuum.
Yeah, they think that the monetary system is a closed system for each country, instead of with the dollar, back to your point, it was a global system. But now I've listened to a lot of your interviews with Eric on Macro Voices and Real Vision. You said that, I forgot the exact date, but at some point in 2007, that global monetary system kind of broke and went two separate ways. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, that was August 9th, 2007. And you can see it on all the charts. It shows up everywhere. It shows up in euros. It shows up in dollars. Because again, this is a bank-centered monetary system. It's not a necessarily a currency system. It's a virtual currency system. What happened on August 9th was essentially a lot of assumptions about how the system worked, about how it was perceived to be very safe, very reliable, because it was a bank-centered system. People inside the system began to doubt if that was actually true, because we started to see with subprime mortgages where some of the things that were taken for granted about the reliability of market mechanisms embedded, liquidity mechanisms in particular, embedded within the system, things were not performing as they should have. And so what happened on August 9th and thereafter was, you know, the idea was that you got bigger, bigger, bigger in the pre-crisis era, because everything was, it was all reward and no risk. There was no risk to anything, you know, recency bias and confirmation bias, because, you know, nothing bad had ever happened. It was believed that nothing bad ever could happen. And furthermore, if something bad did happen, it was widely believed that the Fed would just bail out everybody. But starting in 2006 and early 2007, as these doubts started to creep into the system, what you had was what used to look like a monolithic whole dollar system, whether it was onshore, offshore, whatnot. Geographic boundaries didn't seem to matter. The entire Eurodollar system began to fragment and break down to the point where it didn't really work much at all. And as the crisis developed, what also became clear was that the Federal Reserve wasn't really going to be a help. It was not the lender of last resort, at least not into the Eurodollar system, really anywhere else either. And as those things developed, what happened was, you know, banks said, well, look, we're all by ourselves out here, which is a lesson that was driven home when Bear Stearns failed or was, you know, forced to be taken over by J.P. Morgan. So banks operating the system began to sense that, man, there really is a lot of risk in this system that we didn't really appreciate beforehand. And because they began to pull back, that just made everything self-reinforcing to the point where, you know, as banks pulled back, that forced other banks to pull back, which forced other banks to do it, and just liquidity dried up everywhere.
Right. And so I want to touch on a couple things here. First and foremost, you say when the two systems kind of went their opposite direction, you can see that in the charts. And I think what you're referring to specifically is the amount of liquidity that was flooding into Fed funds while at the same time there was a liquidity shortage outside of the United States. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that's, you know, one of the things you see on August 9th is, you know, the federal funds rate everybody takes is the main U.S. dollar money market rate. That's the main rate for what we identify with liquidity in U.S. dollars. And what happened was, starting August 10th, the federal funds rate actually fell way below its target rate. And it fell so substantially, you know, it caused the Fed to start acting to try to put that rate back up. But at the same time the federal funds rate was falling, LIBOR, which is the main Eurodollar rate, skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And so you had this divergence where what it said was, since LIBOR is a Eurodollar offshore U.S. dollar rate, there was a growing dearth of liquidity outside the United States in this global system because banks were hoarding it in this small pocket, the federal funds market, which is a domestic part of the U.S. dollar system. As I said before, the system began to fragment, and that was one of the main places where you could see that fragmentation take place. All of a sudden, you know, beforehand, LIBOR and federal funds, they moved together as if they were attached and as if it was the same market. And all of a sudden, they're moving in different directions. What that showed was a very important systemic break where maybe geographic lines did matter. Maybe the differences between onshore and offshore did matter. And it was another way that banks began to rethink their participation in this global system. And so for the rest of the crisis, that's how it developed, where, you know, banks would hoard liquidity in federal funds, but the rest of the world, the much larger part of this global dollar system, was starved of liquidity. It was starved of monetary resources. And no matter what the Fed did, it couldn't correct either one. It couldn't get the federal funds rate back up to its target, nor could it get liquidity out into the rest of the system. And the end result was simply the financial crisis.
All right. So what was the Fed funds rate at the time when it dropped far below that? Was it at 4 or 5 or...
On August 9th, the federal funds target was 5.25%.
And it dropped to what?
Oh, I'd have to look that up.
But I mean, was it down to like 3 or was it 4? Was it like 100 basis points or was it like all the way to 0?
Well, there were some trades that went off at 0. So some people were just dumping federal funds at 0. There was a massive another thing about the federal funds market is there is no single federal funds rate. Yeah. It's a spectrum of transactions that take place across a whole range of interest rates within any kind of day. And so the dispersion within the federal funds market on August 10th was enormous. You had some transactions going off at 0, and you had some transactions going off above where LIBOR was. And so you had most of the federal funds taking place below the target, which put the effective rate, which is the rate everybody notices, substantially below the federal funds target. And I don't remember offhand what that was.
That's fine. That's such a great point. And I'm sure no one has any idea that throughout the day, there's a variety of transactions and some fall below Fed funds, some fall, go above Fed funds. And it's just their target or their goal is to try to get just the average of all the, you know, thousands of transactions to hit right around that level. But there could be some far below and far above. That kind of blew me away when I first heard that. But I'm going to do a whiteboard video on that for sure.
Yeah, well, most of the federal funds transactions do congregate around the Fed's target. And so historically, that's what happened. And so that's why on August 10th, when the range went crazy, it was like, you could tell the market was breaking down. Something substantial had broken it. Because, you know, you never see such a wide dispersion where, you know, trades are going off at all sorts of rates all over the place. Yeah. The thing is, it didn't stop. It wasn't just a one-day thing. The federal funds, the effective rate, which measures the weighted average of where all these transactions are taking place, it remained below the federal funds target for a pretty lengthy period of time. And then it happened again during the worst part of the crisis. So again, we saw this disparity where it looked like there was too much money in federal funds, too many dollars in federal funds. And then LIBOR skyrocketed, especially in September and October 2008, which said that there's the rest of the system is completely starved of all forms of liquidity. And then you add into that repo and other things, and it was just a very interesting way to see the breakdown in the fragmentation in this Eurodollar system, which everyone had believed beforehand seemed like a singular monolithic whole dollar. Right. But it really wasn't. It was all these different parts that used to work seamlessly together, because banks that were operating within all of these places actually were motivated to make sure that it operated that way. So that's a critical point. George, when we talk about what, you know, what is a bank-driven, credit-driven monetary system, it requires banks to do things. It requires banks to be motivated. You know, going back to the currency here, we both have to be motivated. I have to be motivated to transfer the $5 to you. I have to want to do it. I have to be able to do it. And I have to want to be able to do it when you need me to do it. And if I'm, for whatever reason, if I'm growing more reluctant about transferring my virtual $5 to you, that becomes very difficult for you. And then what happens? Where do you go then? Right? Yeah, I think that's the biggest point.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it goes back to something we addressed just yesterday. You were saying that the market actually tried to drive rates, the Fed funds rate, down to zero far before the Fed actually caught on and said, okay, we'll take it down to zero to make it look like we know what we're talking about and that we're trying to do this. But that goes back to what you're just saying, correct?
Yeah, and the worst thing your central bank can have is a money market rate misbehave from its target. Because what that shows is that the central bank is not in control. If you're targeting a money market rate and the money market rate is nowhere near the target, that says you're not influencing the money market. And so the worst thing the Fed could have, especially during the financial crisis, was to have the federal funds rate, their main rate, the rate that they have taught everybody for generations and decades to focus on. Here it was misbehaving. It was not performing to their target. And so what they did is they tried all of these different tricks to get it back up. You know, I think that's another important point when we're talking about the financial crisis. You think of a monetary panic, a liquidity panic, a money market rate should be skyrocketing like LIBOR was, that indicated illiquidity. But yet here the Fed's main rate was dropping way below, down to zero, during the worst monetary panic in four generations. And they were desperate to get it back up. And so they instituted IOER, which is the interest on excess reserves. They did a bunch of reverse repos. They worked with the Treasury Department to create a supplemental financial program, which tried to suck more reserves out of federal funds, all to try to get the federal funds rate back up to its target. And it never worked throughout the entire crisis period. The main crisis period, you know, September, October, November, December of 2008, the federal funds effective rate would not go up to the target. In fact, it got worse as time went on and pushed, as you pointed out, it pushed lower and lower down to zero, so that by December 2008, Fed kind of just gave up and said, you know what, we'll just call it zero interest rates, even though the federal funds rate was practically there anyway.
Right. And that reminds me of something I read the other day about the Treasury General account that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I was reading is that prior to the crisis, it was actually in the private banking system. And the Fed said, hey, guys, do us a favor and bring that TGA into the Fed. So we've got it on our side. And so it's out of the reserve system. It's out of use to suck up some of that liquidity that you were just talking about. Am I connecting the dots there?
Yeah, and that's what the supplemental financial program initially was. Yeah. It was the way to, because from the Fed's perspective, and this is the thing that, you know, that should stick in people's mind about it, is from their perspective, there was too many reserves. There was too much liquidity during the worst banking panic in four generations. And that doesn't make any sense. And the reason it doesn't make any sense is because they're focused on this narrow, small corner of what is a massive worldwide dollar market. Right. And so the panic was in all of the rest of the system, not the federal funds market. That's where everybody dumped their spare liquidity. So there was spare liquidity in federal funds, but the crisis was that it wasn't getting out into the rest of the world. And so here you have the Fed trying to take money out or take funds out of the federal funds market and doing very little about this Eurodollar, this massive global spanning Eurodollar system, which was desperately starved for liquidity and monetary resources. And it drives home the point that this system is much bigger and more complicated than what we've been taught and what we've been led to believe.
So can we safely conclude that a lot of those big American banking institutions were providing a lot of liquidity overseas? And when the thing snapped in 2007, all of those lending institutions or financial institutions said, forget it, we don't want to deal with it. We're just going to park our money at the Fed until we see if this thing blows over. And that's what dropped the rates down below the Fed funds rate.
Yeah, and it's not just American banks either. You know, as we talked about in our initial example, you know, once those dollars are let loose into the foreign system, one of the biggest participants in this offshore Eurodollar system are European banks, they're Asian banks, Japanese banks. So, you know, we think about who are dollar providers, you immediately think it should be U.S. banks, right? Because they're the domicile of the U.S. But the biggest dollar providers in the system tended to be European or Japanese. And so it wasn't just U.S. banks that were stepping back. It was everybody. That's why you had a parallel problem in Europe, in the euros. You could see August 9th, 2007 show up in euro markets too, because it's a bank system. And so banks were stepping back, and because of banks, you know, all over the world, it became a global financial crisis, not a subprime real estate bubble crisis, not specifically a Wall Street crisis, but a global financial crisis, because it became a global dollar shortage, which was the rest of the system outside of federal funds.
Okay. And so just everyone in the whole entire system, whether they're European banks, Japanese banks, American banks, said, let's park our money at the Fed until we see if this thing blows over. Let's park our dollars at the Fed until this blows over. And that's why there was excess liquidity there and nothing outside the system.
Yeah. And that's, you know, if they had spare liquidity, they parked it in federal funds or wherever they could. But most of it was just, it disappeared. Just, you know, it's like anything else. It, you know, once balance sheets go in the wrong direction, everything just dried up. Okay. And as you know, it becomes self-reinforcing. As the system breaks down, it causes more risk aversion, which causes the system to break down, which causes even more risk aversion. And the thing just spreads everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. Now that takes us, I want to go back just a little bit, because I've heard you say many times that the real issue with the great the global financial crisis wasn't necessarily that we had all these garbage loans and, you know, liar loans to strippers in Vegas and all that. That was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. But more importantly, it was the system was incredibly fragile. That was the problem. And it was a system that was ignoring, or not really ignoring, but just miscalculated the risk of this collateral. So when that risk, or excuse me, when that collateral started to get some cracks, then they said, okay, we don't want that anymore. Then no, they're not taking the majority of the collateral that they were using in the dollar funding markets. And therefore there was a dollar funding shortage. And that was really the issue with the global financial crisis. It was really a dollar shortage. It wasn't necessarily a mortgage-backed security shortage. That was just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, subprime mortgages were simply just emblematic of the times, right? I mean, again, you know, it had built up over the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, where the underlying motto or the underlying ethics behind the system was bigger is always better, because there's no risk. Everybody believed, you know, once you believe that it's all return and no risk, you always want to do more. You want to do more, because it's nothing but great. It's everything I do wins. And so why not subprime mortgages, right? I mean, what's the next step? You just erase all boundaries, because everything sounds so terrific. And what you had was these stodgy old banks that were buying up every subprime mortgage originator they could find, not because that was the problem, but because that was, you know, how do you get bigger? We have to expand into every kind of market. We have to push every boundary, because everything seems to work. Everything we do turns up gold. And that's, of course, you know, there were people along the way who said, yeah, maybe this isn't quite that good and we better be careful here. But, you know, everybody knows the bubble rationalization. Everybody knows that when everything's going like this, there's a tendency for the crowd to believe that the good times can only go forever. But when they stopped and when the subprime mortgages started to crack, as you pointed out, that began to feed into these doubts that everybody think had in the back of their minds, that, you know, maybe bigger wasn't always better. Maybe everything we did wasn't the wisest thing to do. Maybe we did do a bunch of insane, stupid things. And so how do you unwind it? But when you start to unwind it, if you're doing so in a truly fragile system, as you pointed out, George, that's where you get real problems, because what you thought were strengths end up becoming weaknesses. Where the system, where all these banks believe that they had backstops and liquidity reserves, tended to become bottlenecks, and instead of being a strength, it became a problem. And so it wasn't subprime mortgages that were the issue. They were just the thing that started the snowball rolling down the hill, because it was the systemic issue of how the thing actually worked, really how it didn't work once it became tested, as we talked about before. You know, everybody assumed that this U.S. dollar system would span the world, which nobody had any idea how big it got, because nobody keeps track, or nobody kept track, and even today nobody keeps track. We have no idea how big the euro dollar system is. We have this massive unknown hidden system, and, you know, it's not really a singular system. There's various pieces that fit together. And once those cracks started showing, there was no way to get it back. You know, subprime became just a small issue in it.
Right. And now I want to move forward a little bit from the GFC. And I've heard you talk about quantitative easing. And as we were talking yesterday, I mentioned that the charts that I've seen, whenever the Fed starts quantitative easing, it's very counterintuitive because we think, okay, QE is the Fed creating money, expanding their balance sheet, and then going into the long end of the yield curve and buying these bonds. They're trying to create more demand for those bonds. So the price goes up and the yield on those bonds goes down to try to promote and stimulate the economy, to promote borrowing. Everyone knows the story. But what's crazy is when you look at the yield on the 10-year, every time the Fed did quantitative easing, 1, 2, and 3, you see that the interest rate on the 10-year actually goes up, not down. So prices actually went down and with that additional demand. And so you were saying that this doesn't surprise you at all, because the Fed really doesn't have any control over the market whatsoever. And that's an indication of the market thinking that this might work and that they might start to get inflation again. But then after they stop the quantitative easing, they plateau, then they just have this realization that it's not going to work and interest rates fall right back down.
Yeah, the issue with quantitative easing is, you know, and interest rates overall, is we want interest rates to rise. We don't want them low. Low is bad. And I know that's counterintuitive because we're all taught and we're all supposed to believe that low interest rates equals stimulus, right? Because that means more borrowing, more lending. But think about it. What does a low interest rate tell you? What does a high price of a safe asset tell you? Where banks around the world and investors around the world are willing to hold on and hoard the safest, most liquid assets and nothing else. That's not a very good commentary about the economy. Because look, if the economy is really growing, if there's opportunity out in the real economy, we would. We'd all be selling our safe assets and going after much higher return opportunities. And so if stimulus worked, if there was an actual recovery from quantitative easing, that's what you would see. You would see interest rates rise, which is what happened as, you know, in the initial period of quantitative easing, the bond market said, maybe this will work. And so it would sell off. It would sell off in anticipation of, well, okay, the economy is going to recover. This bond buying stuff, we don't really know what it is, even though we've seen it in Japan and not work for over a decade. But we'll give the Fed the benefit of the doubt. And so interest rates would rise initially because the investors were like, we don't need to hoard safe assets. We're going to go out in the real economy for much better returns on real economic opportunities. Except that didn't last very long, because after a matter of months in most cases, it became very clear in the real economy, quantitative easing didn't work. And in the monetary system, in the Eurodollar system, was even more clear that the quantitative easing hadn't done a damn thing about liquidity risks that remained overhanging from the global financial crisis. And so that's why you would see bond yields come tumbling back down, because the bond market was saying, we gave you a chance. You did all this bond buying. We thought it might work. We sold our safe assets. It doesn't seem to be working. We're going to buy our safe assets back again. We're going to hoard them. And we're going to pay an even greater price for them, regardless of whether the Fed buys them or not. And we're talking about what Milton Friedman called the interest rate fallacy, which is that low bond rates, especially persistently low bond rates, are a sign of tight money in the real economy, as it was in the 1930s, the Great Depression. Real interest rates and bond yields in the 1930s were incredibly low, and they stayed there the whole time for the reason we just talked about. Because when things are not good in the economy, when there's tremendous liquidity risk, you tend to buy and hold the safest, most liquid assets. Consequently, in the 1970s, where there's tremendous amount of inflation and overabundance of liquidity, what were bond yields? They were double digits and rising. And so we have to remember and keep in mind that low bond rates are a sign of, hey, investors are hoarding safe liquid assets. You know, as you pointed out, the prices of those assets goes up. That means yields go down.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Just right off the top of my mind, I am almost positive that if we looked at a chart of the S&P, while those interest rates on the 10-year were going up, the S&P was going up as well, indicating that, to your point, people are taking from this ultimate safety asset into a risk asset like the equities markets. So Yeah. Now, I also remember hearing you say many times with Eric that although we went through this crash and the system broke in 2007, 2008, and the Fed has come in, they've increased their balance sheet to over $4 trillion. They've done QT, QE, Operation Twist, ZERP, NERP, everything you can possibly imagine, the system is still broken. And you've pointed out several, I think three or four times, that are quite obvious that the system is just as broken now as it was before the financial crisis or during the financial crisis. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, what we've observed over the last 12 years is essentially four distinct episodes of these dollar shortages. The only difference between them is the first one got all the attention because of subprime mortgages and Bear Stearns and Lehman and AIG. We haven't had any failures of those magnitudes since then, but that doesn't mean that the system has been fixed or it hasn't been broken. And really all it was, you know, it was a paradigm shift in behavior. Before, as we talked about, before the crisis era, it was always banks were overwilling to expand their balance sheets, which created all sorts, all the liquidity, all of the dollars the global system would ever need. They were very willing and able to do so. After Bear Stearns, especially Bear Stearns, that was the first one, and Lehman just kind of cemented the idea that there was really a downside to doing all of these things that nobody really had taken a second look at. And so after the crisis, we have a paradigm shift where banks are no longer willing to provide liquidity, to provide balance sheet resources like they had in the pre-crisis era, no matter what the Fed does, because the Fed isn't really a part of the system. It's not a, you know, we're taught central banks are central, but in reality, in this bank-centered system, the banking system is central. So if banks aren't really willing or really not able to provide the monetary sources and liquidity, it doesn't matter what QE, it doesn't matter QE, it doesn't matter interest, federal funds rate or anything like that. It doesn't matter about monetary policy. All that matters is what banks are doing. You know, and that's true of quantitative easing and the level of bank reserves too. That's something, you know, I think you pointed out, George. When the Fed does quantitative easing, when it buys these bonds from the marketplace, it creates bank reserves. And before the crisis, there were essentially no bank reserves in the system. The reason was because the banks created all the liquidity, all the quote-unquote reserves that were ever required to finance massive bubbles all over the world. You know, how is that possible? The Fed created none of that money. The private system did it. So what we had was a system of these private Eurodollar reserves that were plentiful before the crisis because banks were willing to create them. And after the crisis, the Fed came in and said, well, maybe if we create some of these, our public reserves, these bank reserves that are the byproduct of quantitative easing, that will help the liquidity situation because it's a, we believe in the textbook, it's a form of money. When in truth, it's really not. It's just one bank liability or one bank asset that banks can use if they want to. But as you know, I mean, you know, we talked about this before, you can't walk into a grocery store and buy groceries with bank reserves. It's not really a form of money. It's a form of bank asset and bank liability. Therefore, if banks aren't willing to do anything with those reserves, they don't go anywhere. They don't mean anything. It's a bank-centered system, which is, you know, I think our overriding point here is because it's a credit-based bank-centered system, everything matters about what banks are doing. And since Bear Stearns and since Lehman Brothers, banks understand that there are risks involved, and they just are not willing to do all of the things they used to do before. Therefore, because we have a bank and credit-based system, you know, the system suffers for it.
Yeah, I want to unpack that just a little further for the person who's following everything. They're really engaged, but they might not have caught that rationale. So when you're saying that you can't go down to your local Safeway and buy groceries with bank reserves, why can you not do that? Because most people think, okay, bank reserves, money, okay, just because it's at the Fed, why can't they take that out and go down and buy gas with it if it's actual money? So can you explain that?
Yeah, well, the only people who are eligible to get bank reserves are primary dealers, which is a specific subclass of U.S. banks and foreign or U.S. subsidiary of foreign banks. So the only entities out there that have access to this Federal Reserve account, which is all it really is, right. You have an account at the Federal Reserve that says you have bank reserves. Mm-hmm. And it's really a legal thing that was established so that you could have liquid reserves on your books to satisfy reserve requirements. So, you know, JP Morgan has all sorts of bank reserves on its books, but but they aren't money unless JP Morgan does something with those reserves, unless they do something on the other side of their balance sheet that expands because they feel confident that they have these reserves as liquidity.
Like,
so if JP Morgan isn't willing to expand, it doesn't matter how many bank reserves are out there or how many bank reserves it has on its books, because what matters is what JP Morgan does, not what the Federal Reserve does.
Yeah, and that transitions into something that we were talking about the other day, where we, well, you, I think, said it really, really well. Well, what happens in the repo market stays in the repo market, just like Las Vegas. Right. And most people, I think, they'd be completely shocked to realize that all, you know, we hear in the news that since September 17th, that the Fed has been injecting all of this money into the repo market to prop it up, you know, blew up, and they have to get that interest rate down. It spikes up to 10%. But what most people don't realize is that they're not really injecting liquidity into the repo market, because that would be going to entities that don't have that account, like you were saying, at the Federal Reserve. So they actually have to give that money to the primary dealers, and then the primary dealers, let's just keep our fingers crossed, put that into the repo market to bring down that rate. But when we go on the New York Fed's website, which I've done many times on my videos, and you look at the transactions, how many mortgage-backed securities last night were used as collateral, you know, how many billions of dollars were did the Fed take in collateral for this much money, that's not really a reflection of what happened in the repo market. That's just a reflection of what they did with the primary dealers. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, and they're pretty sneaky, because they call them repo operations, right? And you're right. The only reason they call them repo operations is because they mimic a repo transaction. They have nothing to do with the actual repo market. And to be honest with you, the repo market isn't just a domestic market. It's most of it is hidden too. It's part of this global worldwide spanning monetary system, where most of what goes on in the repo market, we have no idea. There aren't any statistics that are associated with it. The only statistics we see are what primary dealers report, or what gets taken place in tri-party repo or through a clearinghouse. And so you're right, the Fed is playing a game here. They're saying we're doing these repo operations, but they're not. They're just a monetary operation that mimics a repo between themselves and these 24 primary dealers, with the idea, or just hoping the public believes, that then the primary dealers are filling the need, or whatever need that was, whatever happened in September. We're hoping that by giving primary dealers access to these additional bank reserves, that will fix the problem, even though the Fed really doesn't know what happened in September. And I think the reason they call them a repo operations is just to get the public focused on something else. Hey, we're taking care of it. Don't think about the details. If you start to think about the details, it all falls apart. Really, all we're doing is just giving a bunch of banks some reserves. But if we call them a repo operations, then people will think we're intervening in the repo market. Which, by the way, they've been incredibly successful at, because that is what everybody believes.
Yeah, it's like the coyote running off the cliff, and he just keeps running until he looks down. And then once he looks down, then, of course, he falls. It's like the same thing. But since the repo rate has gone down, would that indicate that those primary dealers are actually doing what the Fed wants them to, or is there something else going on potentially?
Well, the repo rate has come down, as the federal funds rate has. And a lot of it has to do with the repo operations taking some of the sting out of what's actually going on, which is this additional fourth Eurodollar episode. It's creating, it's the Fed taking an example of one symptom of a much larger problem and focusing on that symptom and throwing, just a bunch of stuff at it, hoping that something works. And then if the particular repo rate comes down, then they think, well, that problem solved, when in fact it's just, They've looked at one of the symptoms and they've attempted to alleviate one piece of the puzzle.
Right. And this is why I think someone asked you, well, is a permanent repo facility, is that going to fix the problem? And you said, absolutely not, because repo really isn't the problem. It's a symptom.
Right. And it gets back to what we were talking about before, this wider system of what used to be completely private Eurodollar reserves, private Eurodollar liquidity. That's what's missing. And I think that's what the repo episode showed, was that the issue wasn't the level of the Fed's bank reserves or what these primary dealers have available to them. It was what must be going on in this hidden part of the repo system, the hidden part of the Eurodollar system, because it's creating these problems that, that show up in the repo market. And so, you know, they're looking at everything from the bottom up when they should be looking at it from the top down, which starts with the system outside of the Fed. You know, it's the analogy is they're still looking at federal funds again and not appreciate the what's going on or what must be going on in the wider system outside of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to circle back a little bit as far as our time frame. And I know I've heard you discuss several times that the Fed is doing everything just as kind of an illusion, just to make people believe and have confidence so they'll spend money or they'll lend money or hopefully the private banks will supply liquidity. But everything they do isn't necessarily to achieve the stated intention. It's really just to create this facade so hopefully the system will continue to operate as it should. And I thought that just blew me away when you said that the other day. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, and that's really what we're really talking about here is, you know, this Eurodollar system is nothing new. It didn't start, you know, in the middle 2000s concurrent with the housing bubble in the U.S. This is something that has been evolving since the 1950s and 1960s and really hit its stride and maturity in the 1970s. Now, think about that from the perspective of a central bank. You have this bank-centered monetary system expanding, evolving, crashing through all sorts of traditional boundaries, even creating a different way of doing banking. Some banking and money had changed, and you're a central bank and you still operate much the way central banks had operated historically. And this is in the 1970s, and you think, well, we can't even define money anymore. The way it's being used in this modern system, we can't even define it. As how do we operate, how do we conduct monetary policy when we can't even define what counts as money nowadays? And what they decided in the 70s, and especially in the 1980s, was that they didn't have to. So, well, we'll let the banking system define and evolve its own way of doing monetary business. And what we'll do is we'll create an expectations-based system where we'll move around a single interest rate. In this, in the U.S. case, the federal funds rate. We'll move around the federal funds rate. And what that will do is that will signal to the public and people and, you know, businesses and consumers what we want them to think. So if we raise the federal funds rate, that won't change the liquidity situation one bit. It won't change what's available in the Eurodollar system or even the federal fund system. But what that will do is will signal to consumers and businesses that the Fed is tightening. Now, consumers and businesses are not supposed to think much about how are they actually tightening, because they're not really tightening. All they're doing is moving the federal funds rate around. And so they're trying to influence people's behavior based on what they're signaling with this interest rate. And the reason they've changed to that policy again was because there's no money in monetary policy. They can't define money. They can't even, you can't even, you know, if you can't define it, you can't measure it. Therefore, you can't use it in your policy. And so that's what monetary policy has become. It's been a way to signal central banks' intentions. And that, by the way, is one of the reasons why they pay so much attention to if the federal funds is not obeying its target, that breaks down the whole signaling mechanism, because people are supposed to believe Federal Bank, the Federal Reserve is in charge. And if the federal funds rate is not moving according to what the Federal Reserve says, that breaks down the whole faith and confidence in this expectations-based policy.
Right. And I want to point out something that another thing that really blew me away the other day. It's just kind of, I mean, common understanding in textbooks and, I mean, everything that I've ever read online or on YouTube, that prior to the crisis, the way the Fed would manage, let's call it that, the Fed funds rate, was they'd just go, they'd print money, they'd buy T-bills, and then they'd just inject that liquidity into the system. That would create more reserves, that would bring down the interest rate. But you're saying that that is absolutely not true. And what happened, and this goes back to Greenspan, is that the Fed, to get interest rates down, would just come out and just basically have a press release that they're bringing interest rates down, and they wouldn't do anything. And that, I know you touched on that, but you did it in kind of the terminology that everyone might not understand. And when you're saying, you know, that they didn't inject any liquidity, they didn't print any money, all they did is kind of talk it down. But that you're literally saying that the Fed and all these textbooks are wrong. Every YouTube video that you see is completely wrong. The Fed would never print more money. They would never expand their balance sheet to buy T-bills to bring down the rate or sell those T-bills to bring up the rate. They would simply go on TV, Greenspan, and say that this is what we're doing, and the market would respond accordingly.
Yeah, and that's what's in all the textbooks. It says the Fed controls the federal funds rate with open market operations. And the open market operations are exactly what you describe. They would buy and sell bills as needed. And that would create, you know, again, the weighted average of federal funds transactions. They would be able to influence them through every reserve period. Except that never happened. You know, you can look on the Fed's bed, the historical balance sheet, and you can see the level of bank reserves was essentially negligible for decades. All the time Alan Greenspan was moving the federal funds rate around, it's exactly as you described. All he would do is announce, I'm moving the target up to a quarter point, or I'm moving it down a quarter point. The Fed didn't buy and sell a damn thing during those periods. There were no open market operations, no more than was necessary to do some, you know, maintenance and other you know, technical minutiae. They never had to influence the federal funds market because everybody just believed that's how it worked. And so it was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
You know, if Alan Greenspan says the federal funds target is 5.25, who are we to argue? Because we believe that if push came to shove, Alan Greenspan could move the federal funds rate to whatever his target was. So why fight the Fed? We'll just trade at 5.25% if that's what he says. And so essentially what happened in 2007 was that was the first time that paradigm had ever been challenged. Here came the federal fund. Okay, we need the Fed to show that it's going to buy and sell. It's going to do open market operate. It's going to do whatever it needs to do because the federal funds rate is deviating from its target. And so if the textbooks are right, here comes Ben Bernanke to fix it. Here he comes to push the federal funds rate back up to target. And no matter what they did, they couldn't do it. The federal funds rate essentially broke from its prior paradigm, which was an important signal to the inside of the monetary system because everybody stood back and said, whoa, everything that we had believed, everything that's written in every economics textbook, in practice, first time it's ever been seriously challenged, it broke down. This system is far more complicated. And oh, by the way, the central bank isn't actually in the center of it. It's nothing like what the textbooks say.
Okay, so we touched on the Fed trying to get in there during the crisis and do what the textbook said they should, and it didn't really work. But then they came up with all these other artificial ways to try to get that interest rate up. It was at zero. It didn't want to go above zero because the system was just completely flushed with reserves. But then they came up with IOER, which you talked about before, and that's basically the Fed saying we will pay this 1%, let's call it, on the reserves. So that brings up the rate to that level because the banks aren't incentivized to use that money for anything else at a lower interest rate. But we didn't talk about the ceiling, and I think that's really crucial. So the ceiling is technically the discount window. So if it's at 1% at the bottom, that's IOER, and let's just say it's 1.5% at the discount window. So if the bank runs into problems and no one wants to lend them money, they can go, or if the only money available is at 2%, those banks can always go to the discount window, and that puts that ceiling on there. But you've described many times, I think extremely well, why that discount window is just bank goes there. They're just labeled as insolvent. It's the walk of shame, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy again.
Yeah, the discount window has been, you know, they call it primary credit, and they have for the last 17 years. But essentially, the discount window hasn't changed since then. It's been available the whole time, yet nobody will ever go there, as you pointed out. Walk of shame, whatever you want to call it. Stigma is a very real thing. And so it's essentially worthless. It doesn't matter in practice. Again, it's difference between theory and practice. The system is far more complicated. And what has happened over time, you know, we saw it again in over the last couple of months with these repo operations. What happens is the Fed, in order to try to impose a ceiling, which is really an artificial ceiling, has to grant anonymity throughout its various programs. Right. And then the repo operations, they're granting anonymity by just letting primary dealers bid for these liquidity auctions. And then whoever's actually short of liquidity in the repo market, they'll go anonymously to the primary dealers. Whereas in the crisis, you know, the discount window was available in the crisis. Again, nobody used it. Instead, the Fed circumvented that with something called term auction facilities, which were TAF auctions. They were anonymous. Same thing. And so, you know, there's definitely a problem here because that would essentially be an effective backstop, but it's missing, and it has been missing this whole time. And then you're right to point out that, you know, in the post-crisis era, that's another significant change. Beforehand, you know, it was Alan Greenspan just announced the federal funds target and the federal funds market and LIBOR, by the way, everything just obeyed whatever Alan Greenspan said. In the post-crisis era, even central bankers at the Fed have realized that the situation is far more complicated. So now we have this double floor system, what they call a double floor system, where it has IOER, as you pointed out, as part of it, which is actually the floor for depositories. And there's something else called the reverse repo rate or the reverse repo program, which is supposed to be a solid floor for the wholesale part of it. So, you know, we wouldn't even get into the technical details of what those are, because what it shows importantly is, as we've been saying all along here, the overriding theme, the monetary system is far more complicated. And you can see it just in the way the Fed tries to influence the federal funds rate. That completely changed after the crisis because of the episode, or because of what we saw during the crisis, is that this monetary system is not like it is in the textbook. It's far more complex.
So if you're put in charge of the Fed right now, what's the first thing that you do? Do you try to get everyone to understand that everything they've been taught their whole lives is wrong, all these PhDs, and that we need to start looking elsewhere to find the source of the problem, or what on earth do you do?
Well, the first step is, yes, we need to understand exactly how this thing works. And that's an incredibly difficult challenge. I've been doing this for, you know, 20 some odd years, just looking into all these hidden corners. And I'll tell you, there's still stuff that surprised me today. You know, we really have no idea. We don't have a very good idea, the size, the scope, the mechanisms, the interplay between all of these various pieces that are incredibly complex. And, oh, by the way, they're not standing still either. This Eurodollar system that we talk about today is very different than it was 10 years ago during the financial crisis. Even though it's been broken over the last decade, it's much more derivative-based. It's much more FX-based, which is, you know, how does that matter? You know, where do we go to look at potential vulnerabilities in that kind of a system? So we don't even know what we don't even know. You know what I mean? So, you know, monetary scholarship basically stopped when economists and central bankers in the 1970s decided we can't define money anymore, so we're just not going to even bother. We need to pick that back up again, realizing that we're half a century behind where we should be. We've got to catch up everybody to where it was in the 70s, let alone to get to the 2020s. So that needs to happen first, because if you're trying to do, design or come up with any kind of answer or solution to a problem you can't really put your arms around, that's just a recipe for disaster.
Right. And it goes back. Part of the issue is the collateral. And I think that's what really shocks everyone, because the federal government has been spending so much money and they've been running all these deficits. But because we had this collateral pie back in pre-2007, and let's say 90% of that pie went away, that even though the federal government has been spending like a drunken sailor and providing all of these treasuries for the market, it still hasn't filled up the rest of that pie that was destroyed back in 2007. But so I want to make sure that I'm understanding that correctly. But then also, I know you've discussed at length with Eric how the system in the market, and maybe this goes back to what you're saying with derivatives, has tried to figure out, we'll call them creative solutions to get around the problem with a lack of pristine collateral. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, you're right. You know, before the crisis, mortgage bonds of all kinds, not just subprime, but prime mortgage bonds and all sorts of things were used. They were securitized and turned into collateral because repo funding is the cheapest funding available and everybody wants to be efficient in the financial margins. I mean, that's the whole reason to do securitization in the first place, because you turn a bunch of illiquid, very opaque mortgage loans you put them into a pool, dissect them up and securitize them and turn them into liquid securities. All of a sudden you've got something that's very much, at least in theory, that's very much like a U.S. Treasury security. And so you've greatly expanded through creative means the list of, or the as you put it, the pie of pristine, the best kind of collateral that's of most use in the repo market. Then all of a sudden you have a financial crisis where everybody said, well, maybe we don't like these mortgage-backed bonds anymore. We're not going to take them on the same terms in the repo market. All of a sudden, you've created this massive systemic shortage of high-quality, pristine collateral. And yes, you're right. the U.S. government has done its level best to solve that problem all on its own by being, you know, the brokest, most fiscally irresponsible entity I think humanity has ever conceived. They've created as many treasury bonds as they, you know, it's almost like they're trying to solve the collateral issue on their own. But yet it's not enough. The repo market, so the full scope of it, which we don't know, is so enormous that there remains a shortage of these high quality, pristine collateral securities. And you're right, the market has attempted, these dealer banks within the system from all over the world has attempted to solve it, or at least alleviate that shortage in very creative ways by transforming, by rehypothecating, by doing a bunch of creative stuff with their own balance sheets and their own capacities to create additional collateral or to reuse existing collateral, the existing collateral stock, in order to alleviate that shortage. And it also gets back to what we were talking about before with bond yields. You know, why are banks and institutions, why are they so desperate to hold on to U.S. Treasuries? Because they have a balance sheet utility. They have a repo market role to play, where that, because this collateral is highly prized in the repo market, there's value to it. And so if the shortage in collateral, the shortage in pristine collateral becomes acute again, then you would expect the price of that collateral to rise, which means in terms of interest rates fall. Yeah, it's one of the most systemic issues that we have that remains from the system that broke in 2007 and 2008. We've never been able to solve what essentially is a repo problem.
And that's really, it's so interesting to think about. I mean, it's tough to get your mind around, but once you do, it just really, it's really fun to consider all the options, or I don't know if fun's the right word, but challenging and interesting might be a better way to describe.
Yeah, I think challenging is probably the right word, George, because, you know, look, none of this, it doesn't make a lot of sense to people. You know, the regular person on the street probably never heard of the repo market or probably never had much to do with it. You know, the technical term is repurchase agreement. And so already you can see there's something else going on here. You know, a repurchase agreement is where I agree to sell you a security today and buy it back from you tomorrow. And, you know, for most people, they say, why would anybody do that? Because a repurchase agreement is technically a short-term collateralized loan, but yet it's structured in a way where it sounds like I'm buying and selling a security, and it opens up the door to all of these other things. You know, if I'm transferring collateral, do I transfer ownership? Do I transfer title of the, no, but I retain ownership. But yet when the collateral is in your possession, even though I retain ownership, I'm allowed to do stuff with it. I can lend collateral to somebody else. I mean, none of that stuff really makes much sense, but yet it's because this has been going on for half a century, it has become common practice. And a lot of these common practices they're strange, they're exotic, but also they're anathema to the idea of capitalism itself, the idea of ownership, the idea of, you know, securities are something, they're an asset that we own. And what we find out is that, especially in the repo market and global collateral, is these are very fungible concepts. And banks have often taken full advantage of that fungibility by doing all of these strange and exotic things that no one has ever really tried to account for.
I don't see how that can add any less risk to the system. It seems like that just is adding a whole nother layer of risk, even above and beyond what we had before. But I'll let you guys, the pros, decide that. I want to be cognizant of your time, Jeff. So just a couple quick questions here. I know, just listening to you on Macro Voices, you've said many times that on the short term, you're very bullish on the dollar because of all this demand and all the shortage, everything that we've been talking about. But over the long term, but I don't know, maybe that's 10 years, I'm not sure how you define that you're very bearish on the dollar. So how does that play out? How do we get from the dollar being at, let's say, 99 up to 110, 115, and then back down to, call it, 50?
Well, you know, first of all, as I tell Eric all the time, is, you know, I hate the word bullish because...
Or, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Bullish. Yeah. It's, you know...
I've heard you say it 100 times too, so I apologize.
Yeah, the dollar goes up in value. It's not bullish for anybody, except for if you own safe instruments. Like, yeah, it's bullish for gold. It's bullish for treasuries. You know, but, you know, for the regular person, the regular normal folks that operate in the global economy, it's never bullish. The dollar goes up, it wrecks everything. You know, even central bankers have finally figured out when the dollar rises, that's a bad sign. And the reason it's a bad sign is because of this global monetary system. It's a signal that there's distress and illiquidity in the monetary system that drives the dollar higher. And so I think that's, you know, for as long as this this fourth global dollar shortage is with us, that will be, you know, to use the term, dollar bullish. Now, since we're describing a monetary system that hasn't worked in over a decade, it has to stop at some point. But I wouldn't necessarily think that it has to end with a dollar falling in exchange rate. In fact, I could envision a scenario where the dollar's exchange rate skyrockets, and that's the last end stage of the system. Because right. What I'm looking at is, look, this system doesn't work, but there's no alternative to it. And so because there's no alternative to it and because it doesn't work, at some point it's going to create conditions where there has to be an alternative to it. And so what we're trying to describe is how we go from A to B. And from A to B could be a situation where the dollar shortage just grows so bad that the dollar skyrockets. And that's the trigger for officials to finally say, oh, okay, we really do need to do something about this dollar system, because the shortage has become so bad, the price of the dollar has gone through the roof.
And so, you know, Russia world that has dollar denominated debt, would it be like a Plaza Accord, like a Plaza Accord 2.0?
Well, yeah, if the Plaza Accord was not from, you know, it wasn't a gathering of Treasury officials, it was a gathering of all the heads of all the big banks.
right.
You know, because remember, we're not talking about a central bank-based system, we're talking about a credit-based system. And so the politicians would be involved only in crafting the rules for what the banks are going to be doing, unless we're really talking about reforming the thing from the ground up, which I think is probably something that needs to be done. But I, you know, you certainly aren't going to be able to make that case today, because for most people, they don't think there's anything wrong, let alone something so substantially wrong that it requires rewriting and upending the entire global monetary system. But, yeah. You know, a dollar driving to the moon might be the trigger that finally gets people's attention. You know, 2008 was the time to do all this. That should have been when everybody said, this system is broken. This monetary system that we didn't know was there, we figured out, we see it. Now we can see all the pieces of it. We can see they don't really fit together very well. But instead what happened was Ben Bernanke got away with saying subprime mortgages. And so everybody thought, well, it's just a subprime mortgage problem. We won't have that again. It's all done. So that's what really happened. And so, you know, to get to how do we replace the Eurodollar system, it's got to be something that gets everybody to understand what the real problem is.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it seems like now the problems are all exponentially worse. It's just like, you know, it goes back to the Austrian school of, you know, misallocation of resources and malinvestment.
Malinvestment.
All right. One last question, Jeff. So we've talked about how the whole entire system is built on confidence. It's this illusion that everything is fine, no problem, nothing to see here. If the Fed is got quantitative easing and Operation Twist and all these cool acronyms, they'll always handle the problem and we can go long the market and sleep well at night. What happens to that level of confidence if, and more so the repo market, the dollar funding markets, if the coronavirus really gets out of hand? I mean, is that the potential black swan that could shake that confidence enough to potentially get us back to a 2007 type event?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, look, I have no special knowledge about viruses or what's going on in China, but in terms of analyzing it from a perspective of another risk factor taken into account, absolutely, because, you know, the entire liquidity, the monetary issue comes down to, are banks willing and able to supply dollars onto the market? And for the last couple of years, they've already shown they're shy about doing so. So they're already to some level risk averse, which means they're not supplying liquidity, which is causing the dollar to rise, causing repo to go out of control, all these other symptoms, derivatives markets are misbehaving too. So if the coronavirus turns out to be another risk factor that causes them to become more averse, it could potentially get to a tipping point where, yeah, we could see some of the more severe strains develop in certain markets. I don't think you're going to see another Lehman Brothers. I don't think you're going to see another wave of nationalizations of banks, because individually banks are much better shaped today than they were 12 years ago. That much is true. It's absolutely true. You know, JP Morgan's fine. It's not going to go under. It's not going to need a bailout. It's not going to need any of those kind of thing. But systemically, there are still vulnerabilities where even though JP Morgan or, you know, there won't be another Lehman Brothers, we could still have a systemic issue that causes substantial harm and substantial damage, because banks are already risk averse.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you got Deutsche, you got HSBC, you've got all these other banks where their balance sheet might not be as good as JP Morgan.
Yeah, and even if, you know, even if they are, it's still, you know, we don't need a bank failure to cause a lot of problems.
Yeah.
All right. I think, you know, George, that's one of the big issues is people think things are fine because we haven't heard about Lehman Brothers in 12 years. You know, it's okay. It must be fine because we don't see banks failing left and right like we did during that one particular couple months in 2008. And that's the wrong way to think about it because we've seen all of the symptoms, whether it be bond yields, whether it be derivatives, whether it be, you know, even banks themselves, they're telling you something's wrong. Banks have shrunk over the last decade. And so there's any number of signs that say the system has been malfunctioning. But for most people in the public, their view of it is, well, QE, and we haven't seen any failure, so things must be fine.
Yeah. It reminds me, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and it reminds me in 1980 when St. Helens blew up. And all those people that lived on Mount St. Helens, they kept warning him over and over and over again that there, you know, underneath this mountain or this volcano, it is not good. And they, oh, we've never seen it blow up. I've lived here my whole life. I'm going to live here the rest of my life. And then one day, we all know what happened.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're talking about. Because, right, I mean, the bond market, the, you know, Eurodollar futures, all these derivative markets are the people inside. They're the people who live on Mount St. Helens. They're telling us. Something's not right.
Well, the seismic
thing is, Jay Powell doesn't want to listen. No, you know, the guy in the nightly news, the internet's, none of the internet's, the financial press all takes their cues from the central bankers who don't know what they're talking about. If you pin Jay Powell down at a press conference and asked him to define money, he would have to admit to you he doesn't know how. Yeah, I think that would come as a shock to not only most people in the public, but even people in the financial press. What do you mean central bankers don't do money? What else do they do? The idea that they do only expectation policy would be, you know, I think it would be crazy. It would be a surprise to most people. And yet, you know, the banking, the people who do money, which are these banks and all these creative and inventive ways to do bank liabilities, you know, the, going back to our initial $5 here, all the creative ways to trade these virtual dollars all over the world, they're telling you over the last 12 years, things are not right. We want to hold the safest, most liquid assets. Now, why would that be? You know, something is wrong. Something is missing.
All right, buddy. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'm sure everyone's going to just love this interview. It was definitely one of my favorites, and I just can't wait to get you back on. For those of you or those viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where should they go?
They can find me at my homepage, which is alhambrapartners.com.
Okay, fantastic, Jeff. Let's do it again soon, buddy.
Thanks, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.